All the same, observations that I have made on my own many journeys south have convinced me that the weed itself is not native to our part of the world, but came northward from the lower Anduin, whither it was, I suspect, originally brought oversea by the men of Westerness. It grows abundantly in Gondor, and there is richer and larger than in the north, where it is never found wild, and flourishes only in warm, sheltered places like Longbottom. The men of Gondor call it sweet Galenas, and esteem it only for the fragrance of its flowers. From that land it must have been carried up the Greenway during the long centuries between the coming of Elendil and our own days. But even the Dúnedain of Gondor allow us this credit. Hobbits first put it into pipes. Not even the wizards first thought of that before we did. The one wizard that I knew took up the art long ago and became as skilful in it as in all other things that he put his mind to. 3. Of the Ordering of the Shire. The Shire was divided into four quarters. The farthings already referred to, north, south, east, and west, and these again each into a number of folklands, which still bore the names of some of the old leading families, although by the time of this history these names were no longer found only in their proper folklands. Nearly all Tooks still lived in the Tookland, but that was not true of many other families, such as the Bagginses or the Boffins. Outside the farthings were the East and West Marches, the Buckland, and the West March added to the Shire in Shire Reckoning 1462. The Shire at this time had hardly any government. Families, for the most part, managed their own affairs. Growing food and eating it occupied most of their time. In other matters they were, as a rule, generous and not greedy, but contented and moderate, so that estates, farms, workshops, and small trades tended to remain unchanged for generations. There remained, of course, the ancient tradition concerning the High King at Fornost, or Norbury, as they called it, away north of the Shire. But there had been no king for nearly 1,000 years, and even the ruins of King's Norbury were covered with grass. Yet the hobbits still said of wild folk and wicked things, such as trolls, that they had not heard of the king, for they attributed to the king of old all their essential laws, and usually they kept the laws of free will, because they were the rules, as they said, both ancient and just. It is true that the Took family had long been preeminent, for the office of Thane had passed to them, from the old Bucks, some centuries before, and the chief Took had borne that title ever since. The Thane was the master of the Shire Moot, and captain of the Shire Muster and the Hobbitry in Arms, but as Muster and Moot were only held in times of emergency, which no longer occurred, the Thaneship had ceased to be more than a nominal dignity. The Took family was still, indeed, accorded a special respect, for it remained both numerous and exceedingly wealthy, and was liable to produce in every generation strong characters of peculiar habits and even adventurous temperament. The latter qualities, however, were now rather tolerated in the rich than generally approved. The custom endured, nonetheless, of referring to the head of the family as the Took, and of adding to his name, if required, a number, such as Isengrim II, for instance. The only real official in the Shire at this date was the Mayor of Mickle Delving, or of the Shire, who was elected every 7 years at the Free Fair on the White Downs at the Lythe, that is at Midsummer. As Mayor, almost his only duty was to preside at banquets, given on the Shire holidays, which occurred at frequent intervals, but the offices of Postmaster and First Sheriff were attached to the Mayoralty, so that he managed both the messenger service and the watch. These were the only shire services, and the messengers were the most numerous, and much the busier of the two. By no means all hobbits were lettered, but those who were wrote constantly to all their friends, and a selection of their relations, who lived further off than an afternoon's walk. The sheriffs was the name that the hobbits gave to their police, or the nearest equivalent that they possessed. They had, of course, no uniforms, such things being quite unknown, only a feather in their caps, and they were in practice rather haywards than policemen, more concerned with the straying of beasts than of people. There were in all the shire only 12 of them, 3 in each farthing, for inside work. A rather larger body, varying at need, was employed to beat the bounds, and to see that outsiders of any kind, great or small, did not make themselves a nuisance. At the time when this story begins, the bounders, as they were called, had been greatly increased. There were many reports and complaints of strange persons and creatures prowling about the borders or over them. The first sign that all was not quite as it should be, and always had been, except in tales and legends of long ago. Few heeded the sign, and not even Bilbo yet had any notion of what it portended. 60 years had passed since he set out on his memorable journey, and he was old even for hobbits, who reached 100 as often as not. But much evidently still remained of the considerable wealth that he had brought back. How much or how little he revealed to no one, not even to Frodo, his favourite nephew, and he still kept secret the ring that he had found. 4. Of the finding of the ring. As is told in The Hobbit, there came one day to Bilbo's door the great wizard Gandalf the Grey, and 13 dwarves with him. None other, indeed, than Thorin Oakenshield, descendant of kings, and his 12 companions in exile. With them he set out, to his own lasting astonishment, on a morning of April, it being then the year 1341, shire reckoning, on a quest of great treasure, the dwarf hordes of the kings under the mountain, beneath Erebor in Dale, far off in the east. The quest was successful, and the dragon that guarded the hoard was destroyed. Yet, though before all was won, the battle of 5 armies was fought, and Thorin was slain, and many deeds of renown were done, the matter would scarcely have concerned later history, or earned more than a note in the long annals of the Third Age, but for an accident by the way. The party was assailed by orcs in a high pass of the Misty Mountains as they went towards Wilderland. And so it happened that Bilbo was lost for a while in the black orc mines deep under the mountains, and there, as he groped in vain in the dark, he put his hand on a ring, lying on the floor of a tunnel. He put it in his pocket. It seemed then like mere luck. Trying to find his way out, Bilbo went on down to the roots of the mountains until he could go no further. At the bottom of the tunnel lay a cold lake far from the light, and on an island of rock in the water lived Gollum. He was a loathsome little creature. He paddled a small boat with his large flat feet, peering with pale, luminous eyes and catching blind fish with long fingers and eating them raw. He ate any living thing, even orc, if he could catch it and strangle it without a struggle. He possessed a secret treasure that had come to him long ages ago, when he lived still in the light, a ring of gold that made its wearer invisible. It was the one thing he loved, his precious, and he talked to it, even when it was not with him. For he kept it hidden safe in a hole on his island, except when he was hunting or spying on the orcs of the mines. Maybe he would have attacked Bilbo at once, if the ring had been on him when they met, but it was not, and the hobbit held in his hand an elvish knife, which served him as a sword. So, to gain time, Gollum challenged Bilbo to the riddle game, saying that if he asked a riddle which Bilbo could not guess, then he would kill him and eat him. But if Bilbo defeated him, then he would do as Bilbo wished. He would lead him to a way out of the tunnels. Since he was lost in the dark without hope, and could neither go on nor back, Bilbo accepted the challenge. And they asked one another many riddles. In the end, Bilbo won the game, more by luck, as it seemed, than by wits. For he was stumped at last for a riddle to ask, and cried out, as his hand came upon the ring he had picked up and forgotten, "What have I got in my pocket?" This Gollum failed to answer, though he demanded three guesses. The authorities, it is true, differ whether this last question was a mere question and not a riddle, according to the strict rules of the game. But all agree that, after accepting it and trying to guess the answer, Gollum was bound by his promise. And Bilbo pressed him to keep his word, for the thought came to him that this slimy creature might prove false, even though such promises were held sacred, and of old all but the wickedest things feared to break them. But after ages alone in the dark, Gollum's heart was black, and treachery was in it. He slipped away, and returned to his island, of which Bilbo knew nothing, not far off in the dark water. There, he thought, lay his ring. He was hungry now, and angry, and once his precious was with him, he would not fear any weapon at all. But the ring was not on the island. He had lost it. It was gone. His screech sent a shiver down Bilbo's back, though he did not yet understand what had happened. But Gollum had at last leaped to a guess. Too late.
"What has it got in its pockets?" he cried.
The light in his eyes was like a green flame as he sped back to murder the hobbit and recover his precious. Just in time, Bilbo saw his peril, and he fled blindly up the passage, away from the water, and once more he was saved by his luck. For as he ran, he put his hand in his pocket, and the ring slipped quietly onto his finger. So it was that Gollum passed him without seeing him, and went on to guard the way out, lest the thief should escape. Warily Bilbo followed him, as he went along, cursing and talking to himself about his precious, from which talk at last even Bilbo guessed the truth, and hope came to him in the darkness. He himself had found the marvellous ring and a chance of escape from the orcs and from Gollum. At length they came to a halt before an unseen opening that led to the lower gates of the mines on the eastward side of the mountains. There Gollum crouched at bay, smelling and listening. And Bilbo was tempted to slay him with his sword. But pity stayed him, and though he kept the ring, in which his only hope lay, he would not use it to help him kill the wretched creature at a disadvantage. In the end, gathering his courage, he leapt over Gollum in the dark, and fled away down the passage, pursued by his enemy's cries of hate and despair.
"Thief! Thief! Baggins, we hates it forever!"
Now it is a curious fact that this is not the story as Bilbo first told it to his companions. To them his account was that Gollum had promised to give him a present if he won the game. But when Gollum went to fetch it from his island, he found the treasure was gone, a magic ring which had been given to him long ago on his birthday. Bilbo guessed that this was the very ring that he had found, and as he had won the game, it was already his by right. But being in a tight place, he said nothing about it, and made Gollum show him the way out, as a reward instead of a present. This account Bilbo set down in his memoirs, and he seems never to have altered it himself, not even after the Council of Elrond. Evidently it still appeared in the original Red Book, as it did in several of the copies and abstracts. But many copies contain the true account as an alternative, derived no doubt from notes by Frodo or Samwise, both of whom learned the truth, though they seem to have been unwilling to delete anything actually written by the old hobbit himself. Gandalf, however, disbelieved Bilbo's first story as soon as he heard it, and he continued to be very curious about the ring. Eventually he got the true tale out of Bilbo after much questioning, which for a while strained their friendship.